rose and went to the cabin door, opened it, and put his head out. "Come in," he said, and stepped back to allow Percy Wainwright room to enter. Percy looked dreadful, Gray thought. He was dishevelled, his neckcloth missing, and his curly, greying hair, matted in spots, sticking up in others. He was pale as skimmed milk, with dark circles under his eyes. The eyes themselves were bloodshot, and fixed on Gray at once. "John," he said, a little hoarsely. He cleared his throat hard, then looked away and said, "I'm sorry, John. I'm not brave. You've always been brave, but I never have." This was no more than the truth, acknowledged between them and part of the love they'd once shared. John had always been willing to be brave for both of them. He felt a tinge of sympathetic pity beneath the larger sense of annoyance and the very much larger sense of fear. "So, you made him sign a statement of confession too," he said to Richardson, doing his best to keep calm. Richardson pursed his lips and opened the folder again, this time drawing out a longer document. "Well, it would be longer, wouldn't it?" Gray thought. "How long were we lovers?" "Unnatural acts and incest," Richardson remarked, turning over the pages of the new document. "Dear me, Lord John, dear me." "Sit down, Percy," Gray said, feeling unutterably tired. He caught a brief glimpse of the document's heading, though, and his spirits rose a fraction of an inch. "Confession of P. Wainwright," it said. So Percy had kept that one last bit of self-respect. He hadn't given Richardson his real first name. He tried to catch Percy's eye, but his erstwhile stepbrother was looking down at his hands, folded in his lap like a schoolchild's.
"You did try to warn me, didn't you?"
"You've gone to rather a lot of trouble for nothing, Mr. Richardson," he said coolly. "I don't care what you do with these documents. A gentleman does not submit to blackmail." "Actually, almost all of them do," Richardson said almost apologetically. "As it is, though, I'm not blackmailing you."
"You're not?"
Gray waved a hand at the folder and its small sheaf of papers. "What on earth is this charade in aid of, then?" Richardson folded his own hands on the desktop, leaned back, and looked at Gray, evidently assembling his thoughts. "I have a list," he said finally, "of persons whose actions have led either directly or indirectly, but without doubt to a particular outcome. In some cases, the person, him or her, self-performs the action. In others, he or she merely facilitates it. Your brother is one who will facilitate a particular course of action that in turn will decide this war."
"What?
Actions have led, will facilitate, will decide?" He shot a sideways glance at Percy, who was looking up, but with an attitude of complete bewilderment, and no wonder. "What indeed?" Richardson had been watching the play of thoughts on Gray's face. "I may be mistaken, but I believe that your brother intends to make a speech to the House of Lords. And I further believe that the effects of that speech will affect the will of the British Army, and hence Parliament, to pursue this war." Percy was listening to this in total bewilderment, and Gray didn't blame him. "I desire that your brother not make that speech," Richardson concluded. "And I think that your life and honour are probably the only things that would prevent him doing so." He cocked his head to one side, watching Gray. Gray blinked.
"If you think that, plainly you don't know my brother."
Richardson smiled. It wasn't a pleasant expression.
"You've seen a man hanged for sodomy?"
"I have."
He had, in fact, not only attended that hanging, but had pulled on Bates's legs in the desperate hope of hastening his end. He found that one hand was idly rubbing his chest in the place where Bates had kicked him.
"The American colonies are no more tolerant of perversion than is England. Probably less. Though you might have the luck to be stoned to death by a mob, rather than formally hanged," he added judiciously,
and nodded toward the papers on the desk.
Your brother will appreciate the position, I assure you. You, and Mr. Wainwright, will remain aboard as my guests, while copies of these statements are delivered to your brother. What happens to you after that will depend upon his grace.
He closed the folder, picked it up, and bowed.
I'll have some food brought. Good day, gentlemen.
Chapter 137. Infamous and Scandalous Acts. William's first response to learning of his father's disappearance was to go and look for him. He began at General Prevost's headquarters. No one had seen Lieutenant Colonel Lord John Grey, he was told. They would very much like to know where he was, though, as Regimental Colonel His Grace the Duke of Pardlow had left responsibility for the soldiers remaining in Savannah in Colonel Lord John's hands. And while the executive officers over these soldiers were fully capable of keeping the men fit and in order, they would certainly appreciate more specific orders when these should be forthcoming. At least they knew where Uncle Hal was, or was supposed to be, in Charlestown. Which is the devil of a lot of help, he told Amaranthus after 2 days of searching. But if Papa doesn't turn up here quite soon...
Yes, she said, biting her lip.
I suppose you'll have to go find Father Pardlow in Charlestown if he...
Her voice died away.
If he what? He demanded, in no mood for obfuscation. She didn't reply at once, but went to the sideboard and took down a bulbous black bottle. He recognized it. It was the German brandy Papa and Uncle Hal called Black Brandy, though the name was really Blood of Martyrs. He waved it away impatiently. I don't need a drink.
Smell it.
She'd uncorked the bottle and now held it under his nose. He took an impatient sniff, then stopped, and sniffed again. More cautiously.
I don't pretend to be a judge of brandy, Amaranthus said, watching him, but Father Pardlow did give me a glass of this once, and it didn't smell or taste like this.
You tasted it?
He raised a brow at her, and she shrugged. Only a fingertip. It tastes much as it smells. Hot, spicy, and that's not how it should taste. William dipped a fingertip and tried it. She was right. It tasted wrong somehow. He wiped the drop of wine on his breeches, staring at her.
Do you mean to say you think someone's poisoned this? His natural incredulity was lessened by the worry of the last few days, and he found that he wasn't at all unwilling to believe this.
Amaranthus grimaced, gingerly putting the cork back into the bottle. A few weeks ago, Father Pardlow asked me, did I know what foxglove is? I told him I did, and that he'd seen it. Mrs. Anderson has quite a lot of it bordering the front walk of her garden. She took a short breath as though her corset was too tight, and met William's eye. I told him it was poisonous. And I found that, she nodded at the bottle, locked up in the strongbox in his office. He gave me a key some time ago, she added pointedly, because all of my jewellery is in it.
William looked at the bottle, black and menacing. The fingers of the hand that had touched the stuff felt suddenly cold and seemed to be tingling. He rubbed them impatiently against his sleeve. It wasn't that he thought Uncle Hal wouldn't kill someone he thought needed killing. He just didn't believe he'd do it with poison.
He said as much to Amaranthus, who looked at the bottle for a long moment, then back at him, her eyes troubled.
Do you think he might have meant to kill himself with it? She asked quietly.
William swallowed. Faced with the imminent prospect of telling his wife what had become of their eldest son, and the eventual prospect of having his family and the regiment disgraced and destroyed, he didn't think Harold, Duke of Pardlow, would seize upon suicide as an escape, but...
Well, he didn't take it with him to Charlestown, he said firmly. It's no more than a 3-day ride. I'll go and find him. put that stuff somewhere safe.
Charlestown.
William had not expected ever to meet Sir Henry Clinton again, but there he was, frowning at William in a way that made it evident that Sir Henry recalled very well who he was. William had been waiting in an anteroom of the gracious Charlestown mansion, presently serving as command headquarters for the Charlestown garrison, having requested a brief audience with Stephen Moore, one of Clinton's aide-de-camp, with whom he had been friendly, and one who he knew was familiar with the Duke of Padua. He'd sent in his name, though, and 5 minutes later Sir Henry himself popped up like a jack-in-the-box, his appearance nearly as startling.
"Still Captain Ransom, is it?"
Sir Henry asked, elaborately courteous.
There wasn't any bar to a man resigning one commission and buying another, but the circumstances of William's resignation of his commission under Sir Henry had been dramatic, and commanders in general disliked drama in their junior officers.
"It is, sir."
William bowed very correctly.
"I trust I see you well, sir."
Sir Henry made a humph noise, but nodded briefly. He was, after all, surrounded by the evidences of a significant victory. The streets of Charlestown were pitted and marred by cannon fire, and soldiers, many of them black, were everywhere, laboriously restoring what they had spent weeks blowing up.
"I am come with a message for the Duke of Padua," William said.
Sir Henry looked mildly surprised.
"Padua? But he's gone."
"Gone?" William repeated carefully.
"Has the Duke returned to Savannah?"
"He didn't say he meant to," Clinton replied, beginning to be impatient. "He left more than a week ago, though, so I imagine he'll have got back to Savannah by now."
William felt a coolness on the back of his neck, as though the room around them had subtly changed from one moment to the next, and an unseen window had opened.
"Yes," he managed to say, and bowed. "Thank you, sir."
He walked out into the street and turned right, with no intent in mind save movement. He was at once alarmed and incensed. What the devil was Uncle Hal about? How dare he go off about his own business when his own brother had disappeared?
He stopped dead for a moment as the thought struck him that his father and uncle might have disappeared together.
But why?
The thought died in the next moment, though, as he spotted a familiar red-coated form 100 yards down the street, buying a packet of tobacco from a black woman in a spotted turban. Dennis Randall.
"The very man I wanted to see,"
he said a moment later, falling into step alongside Dennis as he walked away from the tobacco seller.
Dennis looked up, startled, then looked forward and back before turning to William.
"What the bloody hell are you doing here?" he asked.
"I might ask the same of you."
"Don't be ridiculous. I'm supposed to be here and you aren't."
William didn't bother asking what Randall was doing. He didn't care.
"I'm looking for my Uncle Padua. Sir Henry just told me that he left Charlestown more than a week ago."
"He did," Dennis said promptly. "I crossed paths with him as I came down from Charlotte on the, when was it, the 13th? Maybe the 14th?
"Damn what day it was. You mean he was riding north, not south?"
"How clever you are, William,"
Dennis said in mock approval. "That's exactly what I meant."
"Stuckus,"
William said.
His stomach knotted.
"Was he alone?"
"Yes,"
said Dennis, looking at him sideways.
"I thought that odd. I don't know him to speak to, though, and hadn't any reason to do so."
William asked a few more questions with no results, and so took his leave of Dennis Randall with luck for good.
North.
And what lay to the north that might lead the colonel of a large regiment to depart suddenly and without a word to anyone, riding alone?
Ben.
He's going to see Ben. The vision of a black bottle rose in the back of his mind. Had Hal thought of poisoning himself, his son, or both of them?
"Too bloody Shakespearean," William said aloud, turning his horse to the south.
"Fucking Hamlet. Or would it be Titus Andronicus?" He wondered whether his uncle ever read Shakespeare, for that matter. But it didn't matter. Wherever he'd gone, he hadn't taken the bottle. At the moment, all he could do was to go back to Savannah and hope to find his father there. 3 days later, he walked into number 12 Oglethorpe Street and found Amaranthus in the parlour poking the fire. She swung round at the sound of his step and dropped the poker with a clang. An instant later, she was hugging him, but not with the fervour of a lover. More the action of a stranded swimmer reaching for a floating log, he thought. Still, he kissed the top of her head and took her hands. "Uncle Hal's gone," he said. "North." Her eyes were already dark with fear. At this, the little blood remaining in her face drained away. "He's going to see Ben?"
"I can't think what else he could be doing. Have you had any word from Papa? Has he come back?"
"No," she said, and swallowed.
She nodded at an open letter that lay on a small table under the window.
"That came this morning for Father Pardlow, but I opened it. It's from a man named Richardson."
William snatched the letter up and read it quickly, then read it again, unable to make sense of it, and a third time, slowly.
"Who is that man?"
Amaranthus had retreated a little, eyeing the letter as though it might suddenly spring to life and bite. William didn't blame her.
"A bad man," William said, his lips feeling stiff. "God knows who he really is, but he seems to be, I don't know exactly, Major General Inspector of the Army. I've never heard of such an office, but..."
"But he says he's arrested Lord John," Amaranthus cried. "How could he? Why? What does he mean, infamous and scandalous acts? Lord John?"
William's fingers felt numb, and he fumbled the sheet of paper, trying to refold it. The official stamp beneath Richardson's signature felt rough under his thumb, and he dropped the letter, which caught a whiff of air and spun across the carpet. Amaranthus stamped on it, pinning it to the floor, and stood staring at William.
"He wants Father Pardlow to go and speak to him. What the devil shall we do?"
Chapter 138. Inherited Evil. A week later. It was quiet, bar the usual shipboard noises, and shouted orders from the deck of the Palace echoed faintly across the water from other anchored ships. Grey had quite recovered from the effects of his abduction and was somewhat prepared when two deckhands came to fetch him from his small cabin. They bound his hands loosely in front of him, a bit of thoroughness that he appreciated as professional caution, though he deplored its immediate effects, and propelled him forcibly up a ladder and across the deck to the captain's cabin, where Ezekiel Richardson was waiting for him.
"Sit, please." Richardson gestured him to a seat and stood looking down at him. "I have as yet had no word from Pardlow," he said. "It may be some time before you can reach my brother," Grey remarked, as casually as possible in the circumstances. "And where the devil are you, Hal?"
"Oh, I can wait," Richardson assured him. "I've been waiting for years. A few weeks doesn't signify. Though it would, of course, be desirable for you to tell me where you believe him to be."
"Waiting years?" Grey said, surprised. "For what?"
Richardson didn't answer at once, but looked at him thoughtfully, then shook his head.
"Mrs. Fraser," he said abruptly, "did you really marry her simply to oblige a dead friend? Given your natural inclinations, I mean. Was it a desire for children? Or was someone getting too close to the truth about you, and you married a woman to disguise that truth?"
"I have no need to justify my actions to you, sir," Grey said politely.
Richardson seemed to find that amusing.
"No," he agreed, "you don't. But you do, I suppose, wonder why I proposed to kill you."
"Not really."
This was, in fact, true, and the disinterest in Grey's voice needed no dissimulation. If Richardson truly meant to kill him, he'd already be dead. The fact that he wasn't meant that Richardson had some use for him. That he wondered about,
but chose not to say so. Richardson drew a slow breath, looking him over, then shook his head and chose a new tack.
"One of my great-grandmothers was a slave," he said abruptly.
Gray shrugged.
"Two of my great-grandfathers were Scotch," he said. "A man can't be responsible for his ancestry." "So you don't think the sins of a father should be visited upon the children?"
Gray sighed, pressing his shoulders against the chair to ease the stiffness in his back.
"If they were, I should think humanity would have ceased to exist by now, pressed back into the earth by the accumulated weight of inherited evil."
Richardson shrugged slightly, whether in acknowledgement or dismissal of the point Gray couldn't tell. Richardson turned to the wall of glass panes and looked out, presumably to give himself time to think up a new conversational gambit. The sun was sinking, and the light from the big stern window glittered from a million tiny wavelets coruscating across the glass, the ceiling. The ceiling. Did you call it a ceiling in a ship? And across the table at which Gray sat. It flickered over his hands, which were still rather the worse for wear. He flexed them slowly, considering various nearby objects in terms of their effectiveness as weapons. There was a rather solid-looking clock and the bottle of brandy, but both were some distance away, on the far side of the cabin. God damn it, that was his bottle of brandy. He recognized the handwritten label even at this distance. The bastard had been burgling his house.
"I beg your pardon," he said, suddenly aware that Richardson had asked him something.
"I said," Richardson said, with a pretense of patience.
"How do you feel about slavery?"
Not getting an immediate response, he said, much less patiently,
"You were governor of Jamaica, for God's sake. Surely you're well acquainted with the institution."
"I assume that's a rhetorical question," Gray said,
gingerly touching the healing but still swollen laceration on his scalp.
"But if you insist..."
"Yes, I'm reasonably sure I know a great deal more about it than you do.
As to my feelings regarding slavery, I deplore it on both philosophical and compassionate grounds."
"Why? Did you expect me to declare myself in favour of it?"
"You might have."
Richardson looked at him intently for a moment, and then seemed to come to some decision, for he sat down across the table from Gray, meeting his eyes on the level.
"But I'm glad you didn't.
Now." He leaned forward, intent. "Your wife.
Or your ex-wife, if you prefer."
"If you mean Mrs. Fraser," Gray said politely.
"She was, in fact, never my wife, the marriage between us having been arranged under the false impression that her husband was dead. He's not." "I'm well aware of it."
There was a note of grimness in that remark, and it gave Gray an uneasy feeling in the pit of his stomach. The clock on the distant table uttered a clear ding, then did it four more times, just to make its point. Richardson looked over his shoulder at it and made a displeased noise.
"I'll have to go soon." "What I want to know, sir, is whether you know what Mrs. Fraser is."
Gray stared at him.
"I realize that being struck over the head has somewhat impaired my thought processes, sir. But I have the strong impression that it's not I who am suffering from incoherence. What the devil do you mean by that?"
The man flushed, a strange patchy sort of flush that left his face mottled like a frost-bitten tomato. Still, the look of displeasure on his face had eased, which alarmed Gray.
"I think you have a good idea what I mean, Colonel. She told you, didn't she? She's the most intemperate woman I've ever met in this century or any other."
Gray started involuntarily at that, and cursed himself as he saw the look of satisfaction in Richardson's eyes. What the devil did I just tell him?
"Ah, yes. Well then."
Richardson leaned forward.
"I am also what Mrs. Fraser and her daughter and grandchildren are."
"What?" Gray was honestly gobsmacked at this.
What the devil do you think they are, may I ask?
People capable of moving from one period of time to another.
Gray shut his eyes and waited a moment, sighed deeply, and opened them.
I'd hoped I was dreaming. But you're still there, I see, he said. Is that my brandy? If so, give me some. I'm not listening to this sort of thing sober.
Richardson shrugged and poured him a glass, which Gray drank like water. He sipped the second, and Richardson, who had been watching him patiently, nodded.
All right. Listen, then. There is an abolitionist movement in England. Do you know about that?
Vaguely.
Well, it will take root, and in the year 1807 the king will sign the first act of abolition outlawing the slave trade in the British Empire.
Oh.
Well, good.
He'd been covertly looking for an avenue of escape ever since he'd awakened on deck and realized that he was on a ship. Now he realized that he was looking at it. The windows in the lowest row of that great wall of glass were hinged. Two of them were in fact open, allowing a cool breeze to come in from the distant sea.
And in 1833, the House of Commons will pass the Slavery Abolition Act, which will outlaw slavery itself and free the slaves in most of Britain's colonies, some 800,000 of them.
Gray was a slender man, and not tall. He thought he might be able to squeeze through one of the panes, and if he could drop into the river, he was fairly sure he could swim ashore, though he'd seen the river's currents.
800,000,
he said politely, as Richardson had paused, evidently expecting a response.
Very impressive.
He was managing the glass of brandy well enough with his wrists bound, but swimming was another matter. He glanced briefly at the rope. Chew one of the knots loose, perhaps? Ought he to wait until he was out in the water in case someone came in and caught him gnawing, though?
Yes, Richardson agreed, but not nearly as impressive as the number of people in America who will not be freed, and who will continue to be enslaved and then to suffer.
Gray ceased listening, recognizing that the tone of Richardson's speech had shifted from conversation to lecture. He dropped his hands to his lap, pulling inconspicuously to test the stretch of the rope.
I'm sorry,
he said, noticing that Richardson had stopped talking for a moment and was glaring at him.
My apologies. I must have dozed off again.
Richardson leaned over, took the brandy glass from the table and dashed the dregs in his face. Taken unaware, Gray inhaled some of the liquid and coughed and spluttered, eyes burning.
My apologies, Richardson said politely.
No doubt you'll need a bit of water with that.
There was a pitcher of water on the desk. He picked that up and poured it over Gray's head. This was actually helpful in washing the stinging brandy mostly out of his eyes, though it did nothing for the coughing and wheezing, which went on for some minutes. When this at last eased, he sat back and wiped his eyes on the backs of his tied hands, then shook his head, sending droplets across the desk. Some of them struck Richardson, who inhaled strongly through his nose, but then apparently regained control of himself.
As I was saying, he said, giving Gray a glare, it's the revolution in America that will allow slavery to flourish unchecked here, and then lead, in part, at least, to another bloody war and more cruelty.
Yes, fine.
Gray held up both hands, perforce, palms out.
And you propose to do something about this by moving through time. I understand perfectly. I doubt that, Richardson said dryly, but you will, in time. It's very simple. If the Patriots don't succeed, the American colonies remain under British law. They won't engage in slave trading, and their existing slaves will all be freed in the next 50 years. They won't become a slave-holding nation, and the Civil War, that's going to happen in roughly 100 years from now if we don't manage to put a stop to the present war, won't happen, thus saving hundreds of thousands of lives, and the long-term consequences of slavery will not. Are you trying to feign sleep again, Lord John? I might be obliged to slap you awake as the pitcher is empty.
No. Gray shook his head and straightened up a little. Just thinking.
I gather that you're telling me that you mean to cause the current rebellion to fail, so that the Americans remain British subjects, is that right?
Yes.
All right. How do you mean to do that?
Plainly the man wasn't going to shut up until he'd got his entire theory laid out. Such people never did. He groaned inwardly. His head was aching again from the coughing, but did his best to look attentive. Richardson looked at him narrowly, but then nodded.
As I said, if you remember, my associates and I have pinpointed several key persons whose actions will affect the trajectory of this war. Your brother is one of them. If we do not prevent him, he'll go to England and deliver a speech to the House of Lords, describing his own experience and observation of the American war, and insisting that while the war might eventually be won, the expense of doing so will be disproportionate to any benefit from retaining the colonies.
Jesus, if Hal does do that, he'll be doing it for Ben.
If the war stops and the Americans are allowed to win, Ben won't be captured and hanged as a traitor. He won't be a traitor as long as he stays in America.
Oh, God, Hal. His eyes were watering again, but not from brandy fumes.
He's not the only person in a public position to hold that opinion, Richardson added. But he'll be one of the people who, by virtue of chance or destiny, is in the right place at the right time. He'll give Lord North the excuse he's been looking for to abandon the war and devote England's resources to more important ventures. It won't be only Pardlow, of course. We have a list.
Yes, you said that.
Gray was beginning to have an unpleasant feeling in the pit of his stomach. You said, we? How the devil many of you are there?
You don't need to know that, Richardson snapped,
and Gray felt a small pulse of satisfaction.
The answer was likely either very few or no one but me, he thought.
Richardson levelled a finger at him.
All you need to know, my lord, is that your brother must not give that speech. With luck, his concern for your health will be sufficient to stop him. If not, we will be compelled to reveal your character and activities in the most public manner and make the scandal as sensational as possible by having you executed for the crime of sodomy. That should be enough to discredit your brother and anything he says.
He paused dramatically, but Gray said nothing. Richardson stared at him, then gave a short laugh.
But you will have the comfort of knowing that your death will mean something. You will have saved millions of lives, and incidentally prevented the British Empire from making the greatest economic blunder in history by abandoning America. That's more than most soldiers get, isn't it?
Chapter 139. Dreams of Glory. Fraser's Ridge, September the 4th, 1780. I was having the delightful sort of dream where you realize that you're asleep and are enjoying it extremely. I was warm, bonelessly relaxed, and my mind was an exquisite blank. I was just beginning to sink down through this cloudy layer of bliss to the deeper realms of unconsciousness, when a violent movement of the mattress under me jerked me into instant alertness. By reflex, I rolled onto my side and reached for Jamie. I hadn't achieved the stage of conscious thought yet, but my synapses had already drawn their own conclusions. He was still in bed, so we weren't under attack, and the house wasn't afire. I heard nothing but his rapid breathing. The children were all right, and no one had broken in. Ergo, it was his own dream that had awakened him. This thought penetrated into the conscious part of my mind just as my hand touched his shoulder. He drew back, but not with the violent recoil he usually showed if I touched him too suddenly after a bad dream. He was awake then. He knew it was me. Thank God for that, I thought, and drew a deep breath of my own. Jamie, I said softly. My eyes were dark adapted already. I could see him, half curled beside me, tense, facing me.
Dinna touch me, Sassenach,
he said, just as softly.
Not yet. Let it pass.
He'd gone to bed in a nightshirt. The room was still chilly. But he was naked now. When had he taken it off? And why? He didn't move, but his body seemed to flow, the faint glow of the smoured fire shifting on his skin as he relaxed, hair by hair, his breathing slowing. I relaxed a little too, in response, though I still watched him warily. It wasn't a Wentworth dream. He wasn't sweating. I could almost literally smell fear and blood on him when he woke from those. They came rarely, but were terrible when they did come. Battlefield? Perhaps. I hoped so. Some of those were worse than others, but he usually came back from a dream of battle fairly quickly and would let me cradle him in my arms and gentle him back toward sleep. I longed to do it now. An ember cracked on the hearth behind me, and the tiny spurt of sparks lit his face for an instant, surprising me. He looked peaceful, his eyes dark wide and fixed on something he could still see. What is it? I whispered after a few moments. What do you see, Jamie? He shook his head slowly, eyes still fixed. Very slowly, though. The focus came back into them and he saw me. He sighed once, deeply, and his shoulders went loose. He reached for me, and I all but lunged into his arms, holding him tight.
It's all right, Sassenach,
he said into my hair.
I'm not... It's all right.
His voice sounded odd, almost puzzled. But he meant it. He was all right. He rubbed my back gently between the shoulder blades, and I gingerly relaxed a little. He was very warm, despite the chill, and the clinical part of my mind checked him quickly. No shivering, no flinching. His breathing was quite normal, and so was his heart rate, easily perceptible against my breast. Can you tell me about it? I said, drawing back after a bit. Sometimes he could, and it seemed to help. More often he couldn't, and would just shake until the dream let go its grip on his mind and let him turn away.
I don't know, he said, the note of surprise still in his voice. I mean, it was Culloden, but it was different.
How? I asked warily. I knew from what he'd told me that he remembered only bits and pieces of the battle, single vivid images. I'd never encouraged him to try to remember more, but I had noticed that such dreams came more frequently the closer we came to any looming conflict. Did you see Murta?
I did.
The tone of surprise in his voice deepened, and his hand stilled on my back.
He was with me, by me, but I could see his face. It shone like the sun.
This description of his late godfather was more than peculiar. Murta had been one of the more dour specimens of Scottish manhood ever produced in the Highlands.
He was happy, I ventured doubtfully. I couldn't imagine anyone who'd set foot on Culloden Moor that day had cracked so much as a smile. Likely not even the Duke of Cumberland.
Oh, more than happy, Sassenach. Filled with joy.
He let go of me then, and glanced down into my face.
We all were.
All of you? Who else was there? My concern for him had mostly subsided now, replaced by curiosity.
I didn't again, quite. There was Alex Kincaid and Ronnie.
Ronnie McNab? I blurted, astonished.
Aye,
he said, scarcely noticing my interruption. His brows were drawn inward in concentration, and there was still something of an odd radiance about his own face.
My father was there too, and my grandsire.
He laughed aloud at that, surprised afresh.
I can't imagine why he'd be there. Well, there he was, plain as day, standing by the field, glowering at the goings-on, but lit up like a turnip on Samhain nonetheless.
I didn't want to point out to him that everyone he'd mentioned so far was dead. Many of them hadn't even been on the field that day. Alex Kincaid had died at Preston Pans, and Ronnie McNabb. I glanced involuntarily at the fire, glowing on the new black slate of the hearthstone, but Jamie was still looking into the depths of his dream.
Kane, when you fight, mostly just hard work. You get tired. Your sword's so heavy you think you canna lift it one more time. But you do, of course.
He stretched, flexing his left arm and turning it, watching the play of light over the sun-bleached hairs and deep-cut muscle.
It's hot, or it's freezing, and either way you just want to go and be somewhere else. You're scared, or you're too busy to be scared until it's over. And then you shake because of what you've just been doing.
He shook his head hard at this, dislodging the thoughts.
Not this time. Once in a while something comes over you. The red thing is what I've always called it.
He glanced at me almost shyly.
I had it. Well, I was far beyond that when I charged the field at Culloden. This time, though.
He ran a hand slowly through his hair.
In the dream, it was different. I wasn't afraid at all, nor tired. Do you ever sweat in your dreams, Sassenach?
If you mean literally, yes. If you mean, am I conscious of sweating in the dream? No, I don't think so. He nodded, as though this confirmed something.
Aye, I dinna think one smells things in a dream either, unless it's maybe smoke, because the house took fire around you while you slept. But I felt things just now, dreaming. The rasp of the moor plants on my legs, gorse stuck to the edge of my kilt, and the feel of grass on my cheek when I fell. And I felt cold from the water I was lying in, and felt my heart grow chill in my chest, and the beating grow slower. I kent I was bleeding, but nothing hurt, and I wasn't afraid either.
Did you take your clothes off in your dream? I asked, touching his bare chest. He looked down at my finger, blank-faced, then let his breath out explosively.
God, I'd forgot that part. It was him, Jack Randall. He came out of nowhere, walking through the fight, stark naked.
What?
Well, dinna ask me, Sassenach. I dinna ken why. He just was.
His hand floated back to his chest, gingerly touching the small hollow in his breastbone.
And I dinna ken why I was either. I just was.
Chapter 140. 3 rounds with a rhinoceros. Fraser's Ridge, September the 16th, 1780. One would think you'd done this before, I remarked, smiling up between Brianna's knees.
If one thinks I'm ever doing this again, she panted,
but broke off, her sweating face contorted like gargoyles. Wonderful, darling. I said, my fingers on the rounded, hairy object showing briefly between her legs. I felt it for only a second before it disappeared again, an instant's throbbing pulse. But that was enough. There was no sense of distress, only of bewilderment and an intense curiosity.
Jesus, it looks like a coconut,
Roger blurted from his spot, kneeling on the floor behind me.
I'm going to kill you, you effing...
Brianna stopped, panted like a dog, then drove her blood-streaked legs hard into the straw-covered floor, half rose from the birthing chair, and the baby shot out and fell heavily into my hands.
Oh, my God, said Roger.
Don't faint back there, I said, busy swabbing the little boy's nose and mouth. Fanny, if he falls over, drag him out of the way.
I won't faint, he said, his voice trembling. Oh, Bree. Oh, Bree.
I could feel him scuffling the straw as he rose to go to her, but my attention was split between Brianna and the baby. A good bit of blood, a small perineal tear, but no apparent hemorrhage. Pink wriggling face screwed up in the exact gargoyle's expression his mother had had a moment before, heart thumping like a tiny trip hammer. And I was already smiling, but my smile widened as he jerked away from my bit of gauze and started yelling like an angry buzzsaw. "Apgar 9 or 10, I said happily. "Well done, darling, both of you."
"Where's his Apgar?" Fanny said, frowning at the baby. "Is that what you call his—"
"Oh, no. It's a list you run through with a new baby to evaluate their state. Apgar stands for activity, pulse, grimace." He's certainly got that. "Appearance. See how pink he is. A baby that's had a difficult time might have bluish fingers and toes, or be blue all over. That would be very bad." I had a quick vision of Amanda's birth, and of the last blue baby I'd held, and goose flesh rippled over my arms. I closed my eyes with a quick prayer for little Abigail Cloudtree, and for the healthy grandson in my arms.
"What's the R for?"
Roger asked, curious. I glanced up. He was cradling Marie's head, gently wiping back the strands of sweat-soaked hair pasted to her face. But his eyes were glued to the baby.
"Respiration," I said, raising my voice slightly to be heard over the baby's rhythmic and loud cries. "If they're yelling, they're breathing. Come down here and cut his cord for him, Daddy. Fanny, come down here too. The placenta will be along any minute."
"Where's Da?"
Brianna said, lifting her head.
"Just here, lass."
Jamie, who had been lurking in the doorway, tucked his rosary into his pocket and came in to Bree, bending down to kiss her forehead and murmur something to her in Gaelic that made her tired but smiling face blossom. The room reeked of blood and shit and the peculiarly fecund, swampish smell of birth waters. "Here, sweetheart." I rose, knees stiff from an hour of kneeling on the hard floor, and put the naked baby into her arms. "Be careful, he's still a little slippery." He had the faintly waxy look of a newborn, still coated with the protective vernix that had sheltered him in the waters he'd just traversed. It took a moment for my back to unkink sufficiently for me to stand fully upright, and I stretched my arms up, groaning.
"I'm not seeing it yet," Fanny said.
She was still kneeling, peering intently between Brianna's splayed legs.
"See if he'll suckle, will you, darling?" I said to Bree.
"That will help your uterus contract."
"That's just what I need,"
she muttered. But nothing touched the beatific smile that flickered on and off through the exhaustion that veiled her face. She tugged down the neck of her sweat and blood-stained shift and carefully guided Junior's squalling face to her breast. Everyone watched, riveted, as he rubbed his face to and fro on the breast, still squawking. Bree squinted down her nose, trying to move her nipple with one hand, while holding the baby with the other. The nipples each showed a tiny drop of clear liquid.
"See,"
I said to Fanny, nodding at them.
"That's colostrum. It comes before the real milk. It's full of antibodies and useful things like that."
She turned her head to me, squiggle-eyed. "It means the baby will be protected from any illness, well, most illnesses, that his mother has had," I explained. The baby squirmed and Bree nearly dropped him.
"Whoa,"
said nearly everyone. She scowled at Roger, who was closest.
"I have him," she said.
Junior threw his head back and then flung it forward, found the nipple, and latched on with a sigh of exasperation that said, "Well, at last," so eloquently that everybody laughed and the room relaxed. A light tap on the door jamb announced the advent of Patience and Prudence Hardman, their faces alight with curiosity.
"We heard the baby cry," Prudence said. "What is it, pray?"
"And is thee well, friend Bree?"
Patience asked, smiling tentatively at Brianna, whose hair was beginning to dry and fluff, and who looked like a lion that had gone 3 rounds with a rhinoceros and wasn't yet sure who'd won. She was still smiling, though, and stroked the baby's head, looking down at him.
"He's a little boy,"
she said, her voice rough from screaming, but soft.
"Ooh,"
Patience and Prudence said together, then looked at each other and laughed. Patience recovered, though, and asked whether Bree would like something to eat.
"Mummy's made some soda bread with jam in case he should be famished, and there's sweet milk aplenty," Prudence added. "What is thy son's name?"
"I'm starving," Bree said. "As for... oh!"
She broke off, her eyes closing in a grimace.
"There it is," Fanny exclaimed. "It's coming. Ice. Oh."
She was on her hands and knees, peering intently and jerked upright as the placenta slithered out and landed with a healthy plop on the straw-strewn floorboards. Roger and Jamie looked hastily away, but the two young Quakers nodded in solemn approval.
"That looks just like Mummy's when she gave birth to Chastity," Prudence said. "We made a tea of it."
The placenta, dark with its writhing network of blood vessels and trailing the ropey remains of the umbilical cord, added its own meaty aroma to the pungent sweat and the smell of trampled fresh straw.
"I think perhaps we'll bury it in the garden," I said hastily, seeing the look on Bree's face. "It's very good for the soil.
As to names, have you thought of any?"
"Lots," she said, and looked down, nestling the baby closer. "But we thought we'd wait until we met him, or her, to decide for sure."
"We thought perhaps Jamie,"
Roger said, raising an eyebrow at the present holder of that name, who shook his head.
"Nay, you dinna want to have a Jamie and a Jamie," he objected. "They'll never ken who's being called. And Jem's already named after your own da, Roger Mac. But maybe the Reverend."
Roger smiled.
"It's a kind thought, but the Reverend's name was Reginald, and I don't think... And you're already named for Jamie's father," he said to Bree. "Claire, what was your father's name?"
"Henry," I said absently, glancing at the miniature buttocks. A diaper would be needed momentarily.
"He doesn't really look like a Henry, does he? Or a Harry?"
The blood flow had slackened after delivery of the placenta, but it was still coming.
"Sweetheart, I need you to move to the bed so I can knead your belly."
Roger and Jamie got Bree up, baby attached, and safely removed to the bed where I'd spread a canvas sheet. The discussion of names with everyone, including Fanny and the Hardmans, adding suggestions, and Bree declaring emphatically that she wasn't having Little Anonymous going without a name for months, like Oggie Come Hunter, went on for some time, while I kneaded Bree's large, increasingly flaccid belly, pausing momentarily to check her normally beating heart, and then, feeling the uterus stir sluggishly into action, stitched the small perineal tear and gently washed her legs clean.
Well, there's David, I suppose," Jamie was saying. "That was my dad's second name. And it's the name of a king forby. Well, two, really. The Scottish one and the Hebrew one. A great warrior, though given to fornication."
A moment's silence and a small hum of thoughtful consideration.
"David," Bree said, beginning to be drowsy.
The baby had gone to sleep, the distended nipple pulling slowly from his mouth as his head lolled.
"Wee Davy, that's not bad."
She yawned and looked up at Jamie, who was looking at the little boy with such tenderness that it struck me in the heart, and tears came to my eyes.
"Could we give him William for his second name, Da? I'd like that."
Jamie cleared his throat and nodded.
"Aye,"
he said, his voice husky.
"If you like. Roger Mark?" "Yes," Roger said. "And Ian, maybe."
"Oh, yes," Bree said. "Oh, God, is that food?"
I'd vaguely heard footsteps on the stairs, and now Sylvia, holding a tray with bread and jam, fried potatoes, a bowl of stew, and a pitcher of milk, edged carefully into the room.
"I see all is well with thee, sister," she said softly to Bree, and set down the tray. "And the little one, praise God." "Here, Roger,
Bree said, struggling to sit upright with the baby in her arms. Take him. Roger did, and stepped back a little so we could finish tidying Bree and propping her up to eat. I glanced over to see Roger, his face soft, look up from the freshly wrapped baby, and see Jamie, who was shyly looking over his shoulder at his new grandson.
Here, Granda,
Roger said, and carefully laid wee David William Ian Fraser Mackenzie in his grandfather's arms, the little boy's head cupped in Jamie's big hand, held gently as a soap bubble. Fanny, straightening up beside me with an armful of soiled and reeking linens, turned from this beatific scene and looked at me seriously.
I am never getting married, she said.
Chapter 141. A Bee-Loud Glade. Colonel Francis Locke, Rowan County Regiment of Militias, Commander, August the 26th, Anno Domini 1780. Colonel Fraser, I write to inform you that I have received a dispatch from Isaac Shelby, informing me that upon the 19th Ultimo at Musgrove Hill near the Ennery River, a force of some 200 Patriot Militia, from the county militias of North Carolina and Georgia, under Colonels Shelby, James Williams, and Elijah Clark, attacked and defeated a loyalist force guarding the mill, which controls the local grain supply and the river. This, reinforced by 100 loyalist militia and some 200 provincial regulars, on their way to join forces with Major Patrick Ferguson. I am informed it was a hot fight, in which some loyalist militia attacked with bayonets, but were overcome by Patriot soldiers who ran boldly upon them, yelling, shooting, and slashing upon every hand, and thus broke the charge. Captain Shadrach Inman of Clark's Georgia militia was killed in the first attack, but succeeded in discomposing the defenders, who then found themselves in some disarray, and were thus overcome and scattered, some 70 men being captured, and nearly that number killed, whilst the Patriot forces lost but 4 men, with a dozen captured. While I know you will join with me in rejoicing at this news, you must also share my concern. If so many provincials and other loyalists are heading to join Ferguson from such a place as Musgrove Mill, the countryside is roused throughout the Carolinas, and we must expect great trouble if Ferguson succeeds in amassing a large force, which looks very likely. We must prevent him while there is yet time. I renew my invitation for you and your men to join the Rowan County Regiment of Militias, and reiterate my promise that should you do so, you will remain in direct command of your own men, you being solely subject to my command, and upon an equal footing with the other militia commanders, with a right to draw upon the supplies and powder available to the regiment. I will keep you apprised of what news comes to me, and hope for your company in this great endeavour. Francis Locke, Colonel, Rowan County Regiment of Militias, Commander. Jamie folded the letter carefully, noting dimly that his fingers had slightly smeared the ink of Locke's signature by reason of his sweating hands. The temptation was great. He could take his men and join Locke rather than fight with the Overmountain men at King's Mountain. Locke and his regiment had routed a substantial group of loyalists at Ramsar's Mill in June, and made a creditable job of it from what he'd heard. Randall's book had mentioned the incident briefly, but what it said matched the accounts he had heard, down to mention of an unlikely group of Palatine Germans who had joined Locke's troops. Beyond that, though, nothing more was said in the book, for he couldn't help thinking of it as that, regarding Locke, until a skirmish at a place called Colson's Mill in the following year. King's Mountain lay between now and then, casting its long shadow in his direction, and Jamie couldn't leave the ridge undefended for any great span of time regardless. He knew there were still Tories amongst his tenants, and he thought of Nicodemus Partland. He'd heard of no further attempts, but was well aware that almost anything or anyone could come over the Cherokee line without his knowing. He sighed chucked the letter into his pocket, and, unable to sit still with his thoughts, walked up the hill to Claire's garden, not meaning to tell her about Locke's letter and his thoughts, just wanting the momentary comfort of her presence. She wasn't there, and he hesitated inside the gate, but then closed it after him and walked slowly toward the row of hives. He'd built a long bench for her, and there were 9 hives now on it, humming peacefully in the autumn sun. Some of them were the coiled straw skeps, but Brianna had built 3 boxes too, with wooden frames inside, and a sort of drain to make harvesting the honey easier. Something was in the back of his mind, a poem Claire had told him once about nines and bees. Only a bit of it had stuck. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. The number 9 always made him wary, owing to his meeting with an old Parisian fortune-teller. You'll die 9 times before your death, she told him. Claire had tried now and then to reckon the times he should have died, but hadn't. He seldom did, having a superstitious fear about attracting misfortune by dwelling on it. The bees were about their business. The air was full of them, the late sun catching their wings and making them glisk like sparks among the green of the garden. There were some tattered sunflowers along one wall, their seeds like grey pebbles, along with sedum and cosmos. Purple gentians, he recognised those because Claire made an ointment out of them that she'd used on him more than once, and had brought some back from Wilmington and coddled it here in a sandy spot she'd made for it. He dug the sand for her, and smiled at the pale splotch of soil among the darker loam. The bees seemed to be liking the goldenrod, but Claire said they were hunting mostly in the woods and meadows now. He came slowly to the bench and put out a hand toward the hives, but didn't touch one until 1 or 2 bees had landed lightly on his hand, their feet tickling his skin. "So they won't think you're a bear," Claire had said, laughing. He smiled at the memory and put his hand on the sun-warm straw, and just stood there for a bit, letting go of his troublesome thoughts little by little. "You'll take care of her, eh?" he said at last, speaking soft to the bees. "If she comes to you and says I'm gone, you'll feed her and take heed for her." He stood a moment longer, listening to the ceaseless hum. "I trust you with her," he said at last, and turned to go, his heart easier in his chest. It wasn't until he'd shut the gate behind him and started down toward the house that another bit of the poem came to him. "And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow." Chapter 142. Don't you? September the 20th, 1780. From Colonel John Sevier to Colonel James Fraser. We have word that Ferguson's loyalist militia is on the move from Camden, whence he departed with Cornwallis, but has now gone south into North Carolina. Word is that he proposes to attack and burn such patriot settlements as he comes to on his way. We propose to meet him at some convenient point in his progress. Should you and your troops be of a mind to join us, we will meet and muster at Sycamore Shoals on the 25th of September. Bring such arms and powder as you may have. John Sevier, Colonel of Militia. September the 21st, 1780. To the inhabitants of North Carolina. Gentlemen, unless you wish to be ate up by an inundation of barbarians, who have begun by murdering an unarmed son before his father, and afterward lopped off his arms, and who by their shocking cruelties and irregularities give the best proof of their cowardice and want of discipline. I say, if you wish to be pinioned, robbed, and murdered, and see your wives and daughters in 4 days abused by the dregs of mankind, in short, if you wish or deserve to live or bear the name of men, grasp your arms in a moment, and run to camp.
The backwater men have crossed the mountains. McDowell, Hampton, Shelby, and Cleveland are at their head, so that you know what you have to depend upon. If you choose to be pissed upon forever and ever by a set of mongrels, see so at once and let your women turn their backs upon you, and look out for real men to protect them. Pat Ferguson, Major, 71st Regiment.
Fraser's Ridge, September the 22nd, Anno Domini, 1780. I, James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser, being of sound mind.
Jamie wondered how many men paused at this point to debate the state of their minds with themselves.
If you'd been talking with a dead man for the last year, you might reasonably have some doubts, he thought. On the other hand, who'd admit in writing that he kent for sure he was away with the fairies?
Or, if not actually mad, what about men who'd not been sober a day in 20 years? Or those who'd come back from war with something missing, or something riding their backs? That thought made the hairs ripple from nape to arsehole, and he clutched his quill so hard that it split with a tiny crack.
Aye, well, if he wanted his last will and testament to be paid attention to, he supposed he'd have to say he was of sound mind, no matter what he really thought.
He sighed and looked over the quills he had left in the jar. Mostly goose or turkey, but two were barred wing feathers from an owl. Well, he meant to keep this quiet. He cut the owl quill into a good point, composing his mind. The ink was fresh, smelling sharply of iron and the woody scent of oak galls. It calmed him.
A wee bit. Do hereby declare that this is my last will and testament, and so swear before God. I leave to my wife, Claire Elizabeth Beecham, damned if I'll put his name in this, Fraser, all property and goods of which I die possessed, absolutely, with the exception of certain individual bequests, as listed here beneath. To my daughter, Brianna Ellen Fraser Mackenzie, I leave 200 acres of land from the land granted me by the... Well, 2 years more and the bloody crone won't have anything to say about it, if Claire and the others are right about what's happening. And so far they seem to be.
He muttered, Ifrin, under his breath, and scratched out, granted me by the crown, replacing it with, from the land grant known as Fraser's Ridge. He continued with similar bequests to Roger, Jeremiah, Amanda, and after a moment's thought, Francis. Whether she might be his blood or not, he couldn't leave her without resources. And if she had land here, perhaps she'd stay nearby, where Brianna and her family could take care of her, help her to find her way in life, make a good match for her. Oh, a moment. Brianna's new bairn, David, he added, smiling. 50 acres to Bobby Higgins. He'd been a good henchman, Bobby, and deserved it. To my son Fergus Claudel Fraser and his wife Marsali Jane McKimmy Fraser, I leave the sum of £500 in gold. Was that too much? Wealth like that would attract scoundrels like flies to shit, if it was known. Both Fergus and Marsali were canny creatures, though. He could trust them to take care. There were small things to be given. His ruby stickpin, his books. He'd leave the hobbit one to Jem, perhaps. His tools, those were for Brianna, of course, and weapons, if they come back without me. But there was one more important person to be considered. He hesitated, but wrote it slowly, just to see how it looked put down on paper.
To my son?
He'd set the quill down carefully so as not to make blots on the paper, though he'd have to redo it in any case because of the scratchings out. It wasn't as though William needed anything of a material nature from him. Or might he?
Bree says the lad wishes to shed his title. If he does, will he lose all the property belonging to it? But the Duke thinks he can't, and even if he could, or refused it, John Grey will see to him. Who does he have to leave his money to, if not William?
That was logical,
Unfortunately, he was not at the moment. And whether it was love, sinful pride, or something even worse, he couldn't die without leaving something of himself to William.
And I'm no dying without claiming William in public, whether I'm there to see his face when he hears it or not.
His mouth twitched at that thought, and he pressed his lips together to stop it. More scratching out.
To my natural son, William James Fraser, known also as William Clarence Henry George Ransom, known also as the 9th Earl of Ellesmere.
He bit the end of his quill, tasting bitter ink, then wrote,
£100 in gold, the 3 casks of whiskey marked with JFS, and my green Bible. May he find succour and wisdom in its pages. He might find more in the whiskey,
Jamie murmured to himself, but his soul felt lighter.
£10 each to all of the grandchildren by name.
It made him happy seeing the whole list. Jem, Mandy, Davy, Germain, Joni, Félicité. He made a small cross on the paper for Henri Christian and felt his throat grow tight. And the new wee boys, Alexandre and Charles Clare.
And any further issue of any of my children?
That was an odd feeling, to think not only that Brianna might bear more bairns, but also Marsali, her sister Joan, if she married. Damn, he'd forgot to put Joni with his other children. More scratching out. Or William's wife, whoever she might be. He was beginning to be sorry that he wouldn't be alive to meet William's wife or see his children, but pushed that thought firmly away. If he made it to heaven, he was sure there would be some accommodation made for knowing how your family was getting along without you. Maybe letting you have a wee look in or lend a hand in some way. He thought being a ghost might well be interesting. There were a number of folk he wouldn't mind calling on in such a state, just to see the looks on their faces.
Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them.
He smiled at the thought, but thinking of children brought yet one more to mind.
Damn, he'd forgotten Jenny, Ian, and Rachel, and wee hunter James Littlewolf,
and Rachel's new unknown, who wasn't due until the spring. He rubbed 2 fingers between his eyes.
Perhaps he should think more, finish this later.
The trouble was that he didn't dare go to King's Mountain without making disposition of his property, in case he was right about what he thought Frank Randall was telling him.
Would he lie? A historian, sworn to himself at least, to tell the truth as far as he could?
Any man would lie under the right circumstances. And given what Frank Randall had certainly known of Jamie Fraser, he couldn't risk it. He picked up the quill again and wrote,
"To my sister, Janet Flora Arabella Fraser Murray, I leave my rosary."
Chapter 143. Will I tell you something? Sycamore Shoals, Washington County, Colony of North Carolina, September the 26th, 1780. I, of all people, should have known that written history has only a tenuous connection with the actual facts of what happened, let alone the thoughts, actions, and reactions of the people involved. I did know that, in fact, but had somehow forgotten, and had embarked on this military excursion with the historical account firmly, if subconsciously, in mind. I had assumed that the meeting at Sycamore Shoals would be the usual boiling of miscellaneous people arriving at different times, followed by the usual confusion and disorganization attendant on any enterprise involving more than one leader, and that indeed was exactly what happened. I hadn't thought that no one, besides me, would bring anything substantial in the way of food or medical supplies, nor did I realize that none of the militia leaders knew where we were going.
The thought of King's Mountain had been so long in my mind as a blunt, rocky spike wreathed with menace that it had taken on the aspect of Mount Doom, prophesied and inexorable. But none of the militia who were going to end up there knew it. Lacking one Franklin W. Randall's... Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ, I thought. Had Frank's parents actually named him after Benjamin Franklin? Calm down, Beecham. You're becoming hysterical. Brief but meticulous exegesis of the battle. Sevier, Shelby, Cleveland, Campbell, Hambright, and the rest had no idea that we were headed for King's Mountain. We were in pursuit of Patrick Ferguson, a much less well-defined goal. News of his movements reached us in dribs and drabs, depending on the erratic arrival of scouts and the detail of their reports. We knew that he and his growing body of provincials, official British militia, and adherent loyalists who had joined him out of fear or fury, were moving south, towards South Carolina, with the intent of attacking and destroying small patriot settlements. Like Fraser's Ridge, for instance. We knew, or thought we knew, that his troops numbered more or less 1,000 men, which was not peanuts. We had 900 or so, counting me. My presence had caused a lot of staring and muttering, and Jamie had been summoned to talk to the other militia leaders, presumably so they could tell him to send me home. I said I wouldn't, he replied briefly, when I'd asked him how that conversation had gone. And I said that if you were molested or troubled in any way, I would take my men right away and fight on my own. Consequently, I wasn't troubled or molested, and while the staring and muttering continued for a bit, it didn't take more than a week of my attending to the minor accidents and ills that beset an army until that stopped too. I had become the company medic, and there were no more questions as to what I was doing there. While we didn't know exactly where Ferguson was, we weren't precisely wandering in the wilderness either. Ferguson wasn't moving his troops across trackless mountains, and neither were we. An army needs roads most of the time, and the scouts reported which roads the Loyalist militia was following. Plainly, we would converge at some point. Jamie, young Ian, Roger, and I knew where that convergence would be. But that knowledge was of no practical value, as we couldn't tell Colonel Campbell and the rest how we happened to know that. Nor would it be of much value if we could have. We were moving fast, and in the general direction of King's Mountain. So was Patrick Ferguson. We had left Sycamore Shoals on September the 26th. The battle would happen, according to history and Frank, on October the 7th. It was autumn, and the weather was changeable. The first balmy days gave way quickly to torrential rains and freezing winds in the mountains, only to return to a brief sear of heat as we came down into a valley. We carried no tents, and had only the occasional sheet of canvas for shelter, so were frequently soaked to the skin. And while each man had brought something in the way of provisions, these didn't last long on the march. Lacking anything in the nature of a quartermaster or supply wagons, our motley band existed hand to mouth, calling on the hospitality of family members or known rebels whose farms we passed, occasionally raiding the fields and farmhouses of loyalists, though Sevier and Campbell did exert themselves to keep the men from shooting or hanging the loyalists they victimized, or going hungry. There were two or three wagons, these constantly bogging down and having to be heaved out of mud or dragged through streams, but they were for the transport of weapons and powder. Mrs. Patton had supplied a satisfying number of barrels. Some men always carried their rifles, shot bags, and powder horns. Others would leave them in the wagons, unless or until trouble threatened. Jamie and young Ian always carried theirs. I had two pistols, visible in holsters, and a knife in my belt, and another in my stocking. Even Roger was visibly armed with pistol and knife, though he normally didn't carry his gun loaded and primed.
I stand a much better chance hitting someone on the head with it, he told me. Carrying it loaded just means I could shoot myself in the foot more easily.
Doctoring was what I did during the nightly wrangling over precedence. It was clear that somebody needed to be in overall charge, but none of the militia leaders was willing to submit his men to the orders of any of the others. Eventually they settled on William Campbell as the overall leader of the group. He was in his mid-30s, like Benjamin Cleveland and Isaac Shelby, and a well-known patriot, a planter of substance, and the brother-in-law of Patrick Henry. So far as I could tell, his chief qualification for the present command was that he came from Virginia, and therefore was free of the entanglements and competitions amongst the over-mountain men. And he has a loud voice, I observed to Jamie, hearing Campbell shouting two campfires away. He appeared to be apostrophizing the rain, the recalcitrant fire, and the fact that someone had taken the canvas off one of the wagons, letting the guns get wet.
Aye, he does, he agreed, without much enthusiasm. You need one, aye, if you're going to send men into battle or get them out of one.
You'd best take care of yours, then, I observed, handing him a wooden cup of hot, mint-scented water. I'd got a fire started under a sort of junior lean-to made of canvas. Our canvas, not the canvas from the wagon, and a handy bush. But a fitful wind kept springing up, shaking the canvas and blowing wet off the trees, then passing on, only to return again in a few minutes. Do you want a drop of whiskey in that? He considered for a moment, but then shook his head.
Nay, keep it. We may need it more later.
I sat down beside him and sipped my own cup, slowly, warming both my hands and my insides. We hadn't any food to cook. And precious little to eat. Corn dodgers and a bag of apples Roger had coaxed from a farmstead we'd passed. Jamie had made the rounds of his men, making sure they'd got a few scraps of whatever food was available and had places to sleep. Now he leaned back against the trunk of a large pine beside me, took off his hat, and shook the water off it.
"Will I tell you something, Sassenach?" Jamie said after a long silence.
He leaned back to look up at the crescent moon, briefly visible through the shredding clouds, and set his hand on my knee. It was his right hand, and I could see the thin line of the scar where I'd removed his ring finger, white against the cold mottled darkness of his skin, the four remaining fingers cramped with grasping reins all day. "You shall," I said, taking the hand and beginning to massage it. He didn't seem worried or upset. So it probably wasn't bad news.
I was sitting on the porch just before we left, and I had wee Davy in my arms, him sucking on my thumb. And Mandy came up the steps covered in mud to show me a bone she'd found by the lake and ask who'd owned it. I took it, looked at it, and told her it was from the backbone of a beaver. And she looked at me and asked, did I hear animals?
I started to straighten and stretch his fingers, and he settled his back more firmly against the tree and made a small sound of mingled pain and pleasure in the back of his throat. Hear them? How? It had rained on and off all day, but had stopped in the evening, and while I was damp all the way to my underthings, I'd established enough equilibrium of body temperature not to be shivering, and it was tranquil here, away from the large campfires.
Again. She and Jem can tell where each other are, without seeing each other.
They can, I said, a little startled. No, I don't think I did know that. I wasn't completely surprised to hear it, though. I suppose I'd actually seen them do it a number of times without really noticing. Do their parents know, do you think?
Aye. She said her mother counted. Had tried them in Boston. Having them go some distance apart and say could each still tell where the other was. Mandy didn't pay attention to how far it was only a game to them, though she thought it was strange that her parents couldn't tell where she or Jem were once she'd realized it.
Is it only her and Jem? I asked. Or can they hear other people too? Like their parents, I mean.
I asked her that, and she said they can, aye, but not everybody. Just each other and their parents. And you. But not so much. That gave me a shiver that had nothing to do with cold.
Do they hear you?
He shook his head. Nay, I asked. She says I'm a different colour in her head. She kens when I'm near her, but canna feel me at a distance.
What colour are you?
I asked, fascinated. He made a small sound of amusement.
Water, he said.
Really?
I squinted at him. It was dark, and the tiny fire was sputtering on damp wood, but my eyes had adapted to the dark, and there was enough moonlight to make out his features.
Any particular kind of water?
Blue, like the ocean, or brown, like the creek?
He shook his head. Just water.
You should ask Jem if that's what he thinks, I said, and slid my fingers between his, pressing his fingers back to stretch the knuckles.
I will, he said, with a slightly odd note in his voice. If I see him again.
And there it was, the stone in my heart, the lump of hot lead in my viscera. I'd forgotten briefly, worn out by the labour of the day. But the thought of what might happen on King's Mountain was never far from my conscious mind. Jamie felt my shock, and his fingers closed suddenly over mine, still cold but firm, and he put his other hand over mine as well, sheltering it.
If I die this week, I'd ask you three things, Ian, he said quietly. Three things that I want. Will you give them to me? You know I will, I said, though my throat was tight and my voice thick. If I can. Aye, I do, he said softly,
and raising my hand, kissed it, his breath warm on my cold skin.
Well, then, when you can, find a priest and have a mass said for my soul.
Done, I said, and cleared my throat. It might take some time, though. I think the nearest priest is probably in Maryland.
Aye, fine. I'll stick it out in purgatory till you manage. I've been there before. It's none so bad.
I thought he was joking. About purgatory, at least. And the second thing?
Wee Davy, he said. Amanda says that he's like me. The colour of water. He's not the same as she and Jem are. And I think that maybe means he canna pass through the stones.
That one came out of nowhere. And I blinked. My eyelashes were heavy with wet, and drops flowed down my cheeks like tears. His hands tightened on mine, and he turned his head toward me, a barely perceptible movement in the dark.
I've said this before, but I say it now again, and I mean it. If I'm dead, you should all go back. If it should be that Davy cannot travel, give him to Rachel and young Ian. They'll love him with all their hearts, and keep him safe.
I wanted to say, I love you with all my heart, and I can't keep you safe. But I squeezed back and said as well as I could, for the real tears starting, I will. He lifted my hand and kissed my cold knuckles.
Tabalat Mukhi.
We sat together in silence, listening to the rain pattering through the leaves, water dripping from the trees, distant voices. The infant fire had died a morning, though we could still smell the ghost of its smoke.
You said three things, I said at last. My voice was hoarse.
What's the third? He let go of my hand and opened my fingers as I'd done for him a few moments before. But his fingertips traced the lines of my palm and rested at the base of my thumb where the letter J had nearly faded into my skin.
Remember me,
he whispered. We made love to each other, under the layers of sodden clothing, finding little warmth save that at the point of connection.
We kept on well past the point where it was clear that neither of us could finish. Our bodies slowly left each other, and we clung together through the dark until the dawn. Chapter 144. A Hanging Matter. October 3rd, 1780. It wasn't the first time he'd gone to a battle knowing he'd die. The difference was that last time he'd wanted to. The rain had kept them from lighting fires. They'd eaten what scraps they had left and then huddled in the dark under what shelter they could find. He'd found a fallen tree, a big poplar whose roots had come up when the tree went down, making a rudimentary shelter. There wasn't much room. He sat cross-legged, his back to the roots, and Claire was curled up beside him like a dormouse wrapped in her soggy cloak and covered with half of his, her head resting warm on his thigh under the woolen folds. It was the only place he felt warm. He wasn't the sort of soldier who fought old battles over beer and salted bread in taverns. He didn't seek to summon ghosts. They came by themselves, in his dreams. But dreams don't always tell the truth. He'd had dreams of Culloden many, many times over the years, and yet none of his dreams had shown him how Murtagh died, or given him the peace of knowing that he'd killed Jack Randall. "Did you know?" he thought suddenly toward Frank Randall. The man was a historian, and Jack Randall had been his ancestor, or at least he'd thought so. That was how it had all begun, Claire had told him. Frank had wanted to go to Scotland to see what he could find regarding his 5 times great-grandfather. Maybe he had found out what had happened to him, found some survivor's account that told about Red Jamie, the Jacobite who'd gutted the gallant British captain. And maybe that finding out had set Frank Randall on that Jacobite's trail. He snorted, watching the breath curl away from him, white in the dark. Claire stirred and huddled closer, and he put a hand on her, patting her as he might reassure a dog who just heard thunder in the distance. "Uncle Jimmy!" Ian's voice came out of the darkness near his shoulder, making him start, and Claire shuddered, waking.
"Aye," he said, "I'm here, Ian."
Ian's lanky shape separated itself briefly from the night, and he crouched beside Jamie, dripping.
"The Colonel wants you, Uncle," he said, low-voiced. "Someone's brought in some Tory prisoners, and they're arguing whether to hang the lot of them, or only one or two as an example." "Christ, you didn't need to tell me whose idea that was."
"What?" Claire said blearily. She'd lifted her head off his leg, and he felt the sudden chill of the spot where she'd lain. She shook off the fold of his cloak, emerging into the rain-chilled air. "What's going on? Is someone hurt?"
"No one, Ian," he said. "I've got to go for a bit, though. Here it's only damp where I've been sitting. Curl up there, and I'll be back as soon as I can."
She cleared her throat. Everyone had catarrh from spending day and night in wet clothes besides smoky fires, and shook her head to clear that too. But Ian was wise enough to keep quiet, and she settled into the little half-warm hollow he'd made, scuttering into the wet leaves, and drawing herself up into a ball. The rain had actually stopped, he realized. It was only that the dripping foliage all around made the same sound as the rain itself. The respite had allowed someone to light a tiny fire. No doubt someone had thought to bring a bit of kindling in his pack, but it hissed and fumed in the damp, billowing smoke over the gathered men as the wind changed. Jamie caught a sudden lungful and coughed, squinting through watering eyes at the hulking dark shape of Benjamin Cleveland, who was addressing a number of smaller shapes with violent language and gestures of the same nature.
"Ian," he said, wiping his face on his sleeve, "go and find Colonel Campbell, aye? Tell him what's afoot."
Ian shook his head, the movement visible only because he was wearing a hat.
"No, Uncle," he said. "Whatever is afoot is going to happen in the next few minutes." "Damn you for a lily-livered pig, son," Cleveland said, fairly mildly, to one of the smaller figures. "We've got no place to keep prisoners, and no need to try 'em in any case.
I know the smell of a Tory. We'll string him up and there's an end to it.
There was a shuffling and mumbling among the men, but young Ian was right. Jamie could feel the shift of sentiment among them. The doubters were still trying to make a case for mercy, but were being overwhelmed by a rising flame of anger, lit and encouraged by Cleveland himself, who was visible in the fitful light, brandishing a large coil of rope.
"Does he travel a boat with a dozen nooses just in case of need?" Jamie thought, unnerved and growing angry himself.
He shoved between two men and got close enough to Cleveland to shout loud enough to interrupt him.
"Start on Shen," he bellowed.
Cleveland, as he'd hoped, turned toward him in puzzlement.
"Fraser," he said, squinting into the hazy dark. "That you?"
"It is,"
Jamie said, still loud, "and I dinna mean to let you make me a murderer."
"Why, if that troubles you, Mr. Fraser," Cleveland said with elaborate courtesy, "you just turn round and trot back to your wife, and your conscience won't itch you a bit."
That made most of the crowd laugh, though there were still dissenters calling out, "Murder! He's right! It's goddamn murder without a trial!" The breeze changed again, and the cloud of smoke that had hidden the prisoners fled away, showing a line of six men, each with his hands bound behind his back, swaying to keep his balance. And then the cloud split for an instant, and Jamie saw the prisoners' faces.
"Holy Mary," he said,
loud enough that young Ian at his shoulder glanced at him, then at what Jamie was looking at, and said something that was probably the Mohawk equivalent. At the end of the line stood Lachlan Hunt, one of the tenants Jamie had banished from the ridge. Lachlan hadn't let his wife go to plead for him. He was among the men who had left. Jamie's wain clenched into a ball. Lachlan had seen him too and was directing a wide-eyed look of terror at him. He hesitated, but not more than a few seconds.
"Stop!"
he shouted as loud as he could, and young Ian backed him up.
"This man," Jamie said, pointing at Hunt, "he's one of my tenants."
"He's a hell-bound Tory, is what he is,"
Cleveland riposted smartly, and lunging forward, dropped a noose over Lachlan Hunt's head. Jamie flexed his shoulders and felt young Ian draw up close behind him. Before he could carry out his plan of butting Cleveland in his massive belly and knocking him over, then jumping on him and enduring whatever Cleveland might do to him long enough for young Ian to get Hunt away into the darkness, another voice rang out in anguish.
"Lockie," it called, "that's my brother."
A young man was elbowing his way through the crowd, which was beginning to be amused by this second interruption.
"And I suppose that and is someone's grandpa, eh?"
some wag shouted, pitching a wet pine cone that hit the youngest prisoner in the chest. That caused laughter, and Jamie managed a breath.
"Don't matter who they are," someone else yelled. "They're Tories and they're gonna die."
"Not without a trial."
"Please, please, let me say goodbye to him."
Lachlan's brother was pushing urgently through the crowd, which, Jamie saw, was letting him. There was even a murmur of sympathy. Both prisoner and brother were young men, no more than 20. Jamie didn't wait. He elbowed Ian and slid sideways through the crowd. The clouds had closed again, and the light beneath the chosen hanging tree was no more than scattered patches of lighter dark. The tiny fire expired in a final puff of smoke, and young Ian let fly with the sort of Indian yips and howls that were calculated to startle and freeze the blood of all who heard them. Jamie dived under the tree and grabbed Hunt by his bound arms, propelling him violently away into the nearby forest. Lachlan staggered, off balance, but lunged along as well as he could, and within moments they were out of sight of the fire and the stramash that was starting there. Jamie drew his dirk and sawed at the rope.
"Do you ken where we are?"
he asked Hunt. There was a great deal of racket back by the tree.
"No."
Lockie Hunt's face was no more than a dark oval, but the fear in his voice was clear as day.
"Please, sir. Please. My wife."
"Shut your gob,"
Jamie said, grunting as he wrenched and sawed.
"Listen. That way,"
he pointed his finger directly under the man's nose,
"is west.
Medway Plantation is maybe 3 miles in that direction. It belongs to a nephew of Francis Marion. He'll help you. I dinna ken where you live these days, but my advice is to go do it somewhere else. Send for your wife when you're safe away.
The big man fired our cabin, Hunt said, beginning to weep from nerves, relief, and renewed fear.
She's no dead,
Jamie said, with a certainty he hoped was justified. Cleveland was a brute, but so far as Jamie knew, he'd never killed a woman, save perhaps by crushing her to death by lying on her. Not on purpose, anyway. She'll have taken refuge with someone nearby. Send a note to your nearest neighbour, they'll find her. Now go! The last fibres parted, and the strands of the rope fell away. Lachlan Hunt made more noises, babbling thanks, but Jamie turned him and gave him a solid push in the middle of the back that sent him staggering on his way. He didn't watch to see how the man fared, but hared back toward the hanging tree, where a good bit of what Claire called argy-bargy was going on. To his great relief, a good bit of the shouting was being done by Isaac Shelby and Captain Larkin, who were taking vigorous issue with Cleveland's notion of sport. It had also commenced to rain again, which further dampened enthusiasm for the prospect of hanging the Tory prisoners. The crowd was beginning to melt away. Jamie was beginning to feel that wee bit soluble himself, and when young Ian turned up at his elbow, he merely nodded, patted Ian's shoulder in thanks, and walked back through the dark to Claire, feeling very tired. Chapter 145. The Mirror Cracked. October 7th, 1780. 4 days later, the mountain came in sight, and with its appearance a jolt of expectation ran through the men. Jamie felt his own blood rise, and knew every other man felt it too. It had been a long time since he'd fought with an army, but he recognised the surge of strength and heat that burned away tiredness and hunger. Thoughts of pain and loss were still with him, but now seemed insubstantial. God willing, they'd reach the point in battle where death ran with you, and sometimes you could ride it. His mouth was dry. He took a swig of tepid water and glanced at Claire, offering the canteen. She was white to the lips, but she managed to smile and reached for the canteen. The horses had felt that charge of energy among the men, though, and were snorting and jostling, tossing their heads, and she dropped the canteen. It vanished at once in a trampling of muddy hooves. He thought for a moment she meant to dive after it and grabbed her arm, holding on. "Dinna fash," he said, though he knew she couldn't hear him through the rising noise of the men. There was no advantage to silence, and many of the younger ones were whooping and shouting incoherent threats at an enemy too far distant to hear them. She nodded nonetheless and patted his hand. He heard Cleveland's horse bellowing up ahead, and the body of men began to slow. Time to fall out and check weapons, have a quick piss, and fettle themselves. Jamie pulled up, raised his rifle to summon his own band, and swung down from the saddle. Roger Mack was there. He lifted Claire down, her long bare legs a flash of white in the muddy ruins of her petticoats. Young Ian appeared at Jamie's shoulder. He'd painted his face at dawn, and Jamie saw Roger Mack notice it and blink. He wanted to laugh, but didn't, just clapped young Ian on the shoulder and jerked his head at the men, saying, "See to them, aye." "Keep Claire with you," he said to Roger, and went to confer with the other colonels. They'd drawn up and dismounted near Campbell, who still sat his big black gelding. John Sevier's younger brother, Robert, and two other young men had left camp in the dark to scout the situation, and Jamie had a brief sense of falling, hearing them say the words that painted in Frank Randall's account and brought it vividly to life.
"You can tell Major Ferguson right off," Robert Sevier was saying, swiping a hand down his chest in illustration. "He's got on a red and white check shirt, and he wasn't wearing a coat when we saw him. Shows up right well amongst all those green provincials.
He cocked his thumb and finger in the semblance of a gun, closed one eye, and pretended to aim. John Sevier frowned at him, but said nothing, and Campbell merely nodded.
All provincials, are they?
No, sir,
said another young scout quickly, so as to keep Sevier from sticking his neb in.
Near on half of them don't have uniforms, at least.
But they all do have guns, sir, said the third scout, not to be left out.
How many?
Jamie asked, and felt the words strange in his throat.
A few more than us, but not enough to make a difference, Sevier replied.
But in Jamie's mind there echoed another voice, Frank Randall's.
The forces were nearly equal, though Ferguson's troops numbered over 1,000, as compared with the 900 patriots attacking him.
A sort of murmur ran through the men, acknowledgement and satisfaction. Jamie swallowed, a taste of bile in his mouth.
There's more of them, but they're trapped up there.
Cleveland put the sense of the meeting into words.
Like rats.
And he laughed and stamped a large boot as though crushing a rat into bloody mush.
Likely what he does for fun,
Jamie thought. He cleared his throat and spat into the dead leaves. It took no more than a few minutes to sort out whose men should take which direction. Jamie's band would go with Campbell and several others, and he went back to gather the men and tell them how it would be. Roger had been told off to mind me, or as Jamie put it more politely, to wait until the attackers reached the saddle of the mountain.
You'll do most good coming in when folk will need you most,
he'd said to us both, in the firm tone that meant he expected to be obeyed. My face must have expressed what I was thinking, for he glanced at me, smiled involuntarily, and looked down.
Look after her, Roger Mac, he said,
then cupped my face in his hands and kissed me, briefly. His hands and face were pulsing with heat, and I felt a sudden coolness when his touch left my skin.
Akrach, akamorst machi,
he said, and was gone. Roger and I looked at each other with a perfect understanding. He told you, didn't he? I said, watching him disappear upward into the brush, about Frank's book.
Yes, don't worry. I'm going after him.
The brush above was crackling and snapping as though the mountain was on fire. I could see men flickering through the leaves and trunks, reckless and purposeful. It was happening. The curse has come upon me, said the Lady of Shalott. I hadn't thought I'd spoken aloud until I saw Roger's startled look. Whatever he might have said, though, was drowned by William Campbell's shout.
Whoop, boys, whoop! Shout like the devil and fight like hell!
The mountainside erupted and a panicked squirrel leapt from a branch above me and hit the ground running, leaving a spray of moist droppings behind it. Roger did the same, minus the droppings, climbing as fast as he could through the trees on the slope, grabbing branches to help himself along. I saw William Campbell, a little below where I stood, still mounted on his big black horse. He saw me too and shouted, but I didn't listen and I didn't stop, but hitched up my skirts and ran. Whatever happened to Jamie in the next little while, I was going to be there. Roger.
You'll help nobody if you're dead, and ye may be useful if you're not. You may be God's henchman, but you'll follow my orders for now. Stay here until it's time.
Jamie had clapped him on the shoulder, grinning, then turned on his heel, and shouted to his men that it was time. Jamie had given Roger 2 decent pistols, in holsters, with a cartridge box and powder horn, and a large hand-carved wooden cross on a leather thong, which he dropped over Roger's head last thing.
So nobody will shoot you, he said. Not from the front, anyway.
Claire, tense and worried, had smiled involuntarily, seeing the cross, then handed Roger a sloshing canteen.
Water, she said, with a bit of whiskey and honey in it. Jamie says there's no water on the summit.
The men had been ready. They'd swarmed out of the trees and bushes at once, bristling with guns, faces sweaty and gleaming under their hats, teeth showing, eager for the fight. Roger felt that eagerness hum briefly in his own blood, but his part in this fight would be later, among the fallen, and the memory of the battlefield at Savannah chilled his heart, despite the heat of the day. To his surprise, though, the men were crowding up together before him, taking their hats off, expectant looks on their faces. Jamie appeared suddenly beside him.
"Bless us before the battle, Minister, if you will," he said respectfully,
and took off his own hat, holding it to his breast.
"Jesus, what on earth?"
"Dear Lord," he started, with not the faintest notion what might come next. But a few words showed up, and then a few more.
"Protect us, we pray, O Lord, and be with us this day in battle. Grant us mercy in our extremities, and grant us the grace to show mercy where we can. Amen."
"Amen," he repeated more strongly, and the men murmured amen and put their hats back on. Jamie raised his rifle overhead and shouted,
"To Colonel Campbell, at the quick march."
The militia drew together with a growl of satisfaction and set off at once toward Colonel Campbell, who sat his black gelding on the rough track at the base of the mountain. Jamie looked after them, then turned suddenly and pressed his hand over the cross on Roger's breast.
"Pray for me," he said in a low voice,
and then was gone. Chapter 146. The curse has come upon me. Claire. The shooting started before I had made it 100 feet up the hill, slipping on dead leaves and grabbing branches to save myself falling. Panicked, I whirled round and ran downhill, but slipped almost at once, tripped on a rock, and tobogganed a few feet on my stomach, arms flung out. I slammed into a sapling of some sort. It bent, and I rolled over it, ending flat on my back. I lay frozen for a moment, gasping for breath, hearing the battle begin in earnest. Then I turned over, got to my hands and knees, and started crawling up the mountain. Jamie. It was fast, and it was fierce. Frank Randall had described it as a just fight, and he wasn't wrong about that, though maybe he hadn't been thinking about wringing with sweat and breathing air full of gun smoke. He gave a sharp whistle, and a few of his men in hearing ran to his side.
"We'll go up, but go canny," he said, shouting over the crack of the guns. "The provincials have bayonets, and they'll use them. If they do, fall away to the side. Come back up somewhere else."
Nods, and they were pushing upward, pausing every few feet to fire and reload, dodge to another tree and do it again. It wasn't only gun smoke now, but the smell of battered trees, sap, and burning wood. It wasn't bayonets yet. Claire. I had to stop, 100 feet lower than the summit. I stood plastered against a big walnut tree, eyes closed, holding on hard. A ball slammed into the trunk just above my head, and I jerked my arms back in panic. More balls were humming through the trees, shredding leaves, making sharp little pocks as they struck wood. Occasional brief cries and grunts nearby indicated that flesh was being struck as well. I dug my fingers so hard into the bark that sharp bits were wedged under my nails, but I was much too scared to worry about it. They'd seen me move. An instant later, shots struck the tree in a fusillage that sent bark and wood chips flying. They stung my face and flew into my eyes. I pressed hard to the tree, eyes shut tight and watering, using all my strength not to run downhill, shrieking. I was shaking everywhere and couldn't tell if it was sweat or urine running down my legs, and didn't care. It seemed to go on for a very long time. I could hear my heart booming in my ears and clung to the sound. I was scared, very scared, but no longer panicked. My heart was still beating. I hadn't been shot. Yet. The memory of Monmouth shuddered through me.
My eyes were burning and filled with the dizziness of spinning leaves and an empty sky, and I felt my blood draining out, my knees giving way.
Whoop, whoop! One more! One more!
It was Campbell's voice behind and below me. And in the next second, screams and bellows and shrieks broke out, and men rushed close past me, clanking and thumping and bellowing when they could draw enough breath to do it.
Jesus! Where's Roger?
Jamie. He rammed the rod home and home again, paused to gulp air and touch the lumpy shot pouch on his belt. How many left? Enough. They were close enough to the meadow now as to be able to see the enemy. He stepped out from the shelter of his tree and fired. Then he heard a faint, sharp whistle. Ferguson. That was him. Randall said the wee man hadn't enough voice to call above the roar of battle, so he used a whistle to manage his troops.
Like calling in a pack of sheepdogs, he thought.
A shout came from above, repeated and echoed across the meadow.
Fix bayonets.
Claire. There were scattered shouts from above, distant. Then all of a sudden there was another ragged roar from the besiegers, and the forest was moving. Men running up from the shelter of their trees, leaping, crawling upward around me, powder horns swinging and rifles in hand. I heard a shrill whistle through the uproar far above, and then another and another. Ferguson rallying his troops. But now I was hearing a fresh outbreak of battle far above me. A few shots now, and the sort of yelling men do when they're beyond words. A shrill whistle and the spreading cry of bayonets. Still shaking, I forced myself to stand up. I wiped a sleeve across my face and saw the forest blurred and shattered around me. Broken limbs dangled from trees, and the air was thick with the smell of crushed plants and powder smoke. And men were still running uphill, panting, flickering through the trees. One knocked into me in passing, and I fell back against the big walnut tree.
Auntie!
Young Ian appeared suddenly, grasping my arm.
What are you doing here? Are you all right? What have you done with Roger Mack?
I hadn't managed more than a faint bleat in reply when I heard Colonel Campbell's voice bellowing somewhere below me.
One more, boys! One more whoop!
Answering whoops rose from every man near enough to hear him. Ian disappeared up the hill into the rising smoke, leaving me swaying like one of the broken tree limbs, hanging by a thread of bark. Suddenly there was a crunch and a slither of dirt as someone slipped and a muffled curse, and I turned to look into the face of a woman. She was as startled as I was. We stared at each other for an instant, and I registered nothing but her eyes black with terror. She ran past me, stumbling and falling and rising in what seemed the same movement, and disappeared down the mountain. I blinked, not sure I'd seen her at all. But I had. She'd ripped her dress and left a strip of her yellow calico gown fluttering from a dogwood. I looked around, dazed.
What the devil are you doing here?
Colonel Campbell was on foot now, next to me, still in his shirt sleeves, face black with powder smoke.
Go down at once, ma'am.
He didn't pause to see if I obeyed, but ran upward, shouting. There were cries from above and a wash of men coming down, but only a little way. Then moving to the side, following an officer for another try. Two crows came sailing down and landed in a nearby tree, eyeing me with casual interest. One noticed the flapping yellow rag and hopped down, pecking at it. My mouth was dry, and when I raised a hand to wipe the sweat from my forehead, I realized that my face was imprinted